First, I want to apologize that I will be using slides, but someone told me that my slides talk is more understandable. So I don't know, let's see. And so I talk about global region theory. That's the outline. So first I give a brief, really brief introduction, which you may already know. I talk about global region theory, mirror symmetry, just something that we already know like over 20 years ago. Sorry about that. part two is still a review about absolute global region theories and definitions and some structural properties for absolute global region theory. So this part two, this part is also already known like for really long time. So the main part is, the reason I talk about part two is that there are not just things from part two that can be generalized to part three, which is relative global region theory, which is in the title. And so I talk about the definition and how to get structural properties for relative global region theory, and there are some applications. Okay, so this is the part that you already know. Global region theory is a theory about counting curves, and so it gives a virtual count of algebraic varieties, and it's the first modern approach in enumerative geometry. And enumerative geometry means you're counting some certain kind of objects, geometric objects. So let's see. Oh yeah. So the next thing is that I want to mention some like earlier results in global region theory. This may be the first like famous result is by Konservich. It gives, using global region theory, it can give a recursion formula for the number of rational curves in P2 of degree d through 3d minus 1 points. So when d equals 1, its lines go through 2 points. It's 1. And d equals 2, its number of conics through 5 points. It's also 1. So there's a recursion formula proved by Konservich in 1994. In terms of mirror symmetry, the most famous example, of course, is quintethreefold. So for quintethreefold, by Kleiman's conjecture, there are only finitely many rational curves in each degree. And if we call this nd, then there are some computations about these numbers. It gets more and more complicated. Then there's no way to see the patterns or the relations between these numbers unless you know some physics or the mirror symmetry. And by the mirror symmetry, this can be calculated using mirror symmetry and using the B model. So mathematically, it's proved by Giventhal, Liu Yao, for quintics. So mirror symmetry is coming from string theory. Everyone here knows more physics than me, so I don't know how much I should say about this, but yeah, mirror symmetry is a duality of two theories, A model and B model, between Calabi Yau variety and its mirror. So the A model of X is like symplectic geometry of X. It's dual to the B model of X dual, X check. And B model of X, which is complex geometry, is related to the symplectic geometry of X check. And you can also extend it to like beyond Calabi Yau varieties. So like, for example, Fano varieties, there's Landau-Ginzburg model. And Which means you have a variety with a super potential. So these two kind of mirror symmetry, they kind of different. They look different. But like there's Calabi-Yau mirror symmetry and Fano Landau-Ginzburg mirror symmetry. There's a conjecture that can relate these two kind of mirror symmetry, which maybe I will talk about that later if I have time. So the A model data is the generating function of general zero Kolmogorov region invariance. So I will talk about the A model side today. So speaking of A side, last night when I checked in, it's a two-bedroom apartment. It has room A and room B. So I have to decide if I stay in A side or B side. And of course, I have to stay on A side because I am doing Kolmogorov region theory. And so I mean, I take a look at the B side and then I just go to the A side. It's like how I do my research. There's a mirror in the room, but there's no mirror in the middle. Like, yeah, the middle is just a living room, and yeah, but the two sides are the same, like exactly the same. And it's like here, there's a mirror map, but there's no mirror map in my room, but both sides are the same, like has the same information. Okay. And the B model, for totally complete sessions, like the B model data will be periods, which will be some hypergeometric series or high function. And the mirror theorem says that the J function equals I function by mirror map. And oh, that's the introduction part. Mm-hmm. If you just come in, it didn't miss anything. Yeah. And part two is absolute Kolmogorov region theory. And although you may have already know about the definition, but let me just briefly review the definition. And so it's a curve counting theory. Instead of studying curves, we study maps from curves to the target varieties. So for the intersection theory, we study the moduli space of stable maps. So we have a curve with some markings and map to X. The degree is the push-pull of the fundamental class. It's stable, means we have finite automorphisms. So get a moduli space, and there are some properties of this moduli space. Some of them are not nice, but yeah, you have evaluation maps, and which can map to the image of the marking, and under some nice conditions, that this moduli space will be non-singular of this dimension. In general, there's no fundamental class. There's only a virtual fundamental class and of the expected dimension. I mean, there may be like multiple components of the moduli space with different dimensions, but there's virtual fundamental class as a replacement of the usual fundamental class and of the expected dimension. And you can use this virtual fundamental class to do intersection theory on this moduli space. And the intersection numbers are Kolmogorov region invariants. And it's basically the definition, but I will actually give the definition here. And So we have no evaluation map. We can pull back some cohomology classes and then intersect the virtual fundamental class. If the dimension is correct, then you get a number. Otherwise, you get zero. And you can, in here, you can also add some, you can also have some other kind of cohomology classes, a precise class, which means descending classes. And yeah, like, but for this, like if these gamma i's are like dual of some cycles, it means like it, you have this, you're counting this curve and intersect these cycles. And then you get the virtual count of these kind of curves. And now for example, if we have quintic threefold, then gender zero with no marking, then this part is zero, it's dimension three, and this is zero because club ER and n equals zero. So the dimension, the virtual dimension is zero. So there's no insertion here, it's just counting the rational curves in quintic. And that's an example of Kolmogorov invariance. And so we can generalize this definition to like more general objects. Like I was talking about these smooth projective varieties, and you can generalize that to orbifolds or smooth Dirichlet manifold stacks. And you can also have relative Kolmogorov theory, which means you have a variety with a smooth divisor. And you can also allow the divisor to be normal crossing divisors, and you get log Kolmogorov invariance. And you can further generalize that to have something that some people call puncture Kolmogorov invariance, which allow negative counter orders, whatever that means. But you can further generalize that. And you can also count disk instead of count curves, which gives open Kolmogorov invariance that only defined in symplectic geometry. And the definition that I talk about here is the definition in algebraic geometry. open invariants are defined in symplectic geometry. So that's the definition for Kolmogorov invariants. There are a lot of structural properties for Kolmogorov invariants. That's one of the reasons that we study Kolmogorov theory. That you have a lot of structural properties, then you can prove a lot of things for Kolmogorov theory. Like for example, we have quantum cohomology, have a bunch of equations, like a string equation, divisor equation, dilatant equation, topological recursion relation, WDVV equation, a given tiles formal reason, and as in a solo constraint, a cohomological field theory, and all of this. And I will not talk about all these properties, but maybe I will just mention one of these, which may be the most famous one, which is quantum cohomology, which this is a deformation of the usual cohomology ring using Kolmogorov invariance. So you have quantum product, which is the usual cut product plus something that's deformed by the Kolmogorov invariance. So in here, this is Kolmogorov invariant with turn zero, three markings, degree D. This is called small quantum product. You can also allow like n plus one markings, and then you'll get a big quantum product. Okay. Now, for relative chromofluorescence theory, what we want to do is to have most of these properties for relative chromofluorescence theory. So once we have all these properties, there are lots of things you can try to do for relative chromofluorescence theories. So in the past 2 decades, like there are lots of results in absolute chromofluorescence theories that like mirror symmetry and or others. And we didn't have this similar properties for relative chromofluorescence theory, so there are lots of works can be done after we build the structural properties. Anyway, I'll talk more about that later. But first, the definition of relative chromofluorescence theory or relative chromofluorescence invariance is accounting curves with tangency condition along the divisor. This is the intersection number between the curve and the divisor, and this Ki is a partition which specifies the contail order at the relative marking. So this is the moduli space of relative stable maps. Now we have M cross M points. So M, the first M markings are relative markings, which means they map to the divisor. So the first M markings map to the divisor, and the last M markings, they map to the just ordinary markings, they map to X. So we have two types of evaluation maps, map to D and map to X. It depends on what kind of marking you have. And now, just like the definition for absolute chromofluorescence theory, we can have some cohomology classes and then pull back these cohomology classes. And the intersection number is a relative chromofluorescence invariant. So there's also a virtual dimension constraint, the sum of the degree of the cohomology classes has to be the virtual dimension of the moduli space. Then you get a number.
Was the interesting for stability in this case? Like, is it kind of easier to be stable if you have like this tangency condition? Does that limit automorphisms or
but you still have other, like you may have other components, right? That does not include any relative markings, it's also possible.
Stable, like normal, but
yeah.
Like for P1, like are there now, if you have one marked point, but it has kind of enough tangency condition, can it be stable or something? Like, how does it?
Yeah, if you have one relative marking and no other markings, is it stable? I don't remember, maybe is it easier to guess if you have a component with this relative markings and see? No, you don't, then it's may not be stable.
Why is it stable?
In general zero, like in the ordinary like chromofluorescence theory, you need to have three markings, right? If it's degree zero, and then I think it's possible you can have. Is it stable? No.
So those curves are assumed to be pre-stable or?
Yeah, pre-stable.
Okay, mm-hmm. So every PLAP has at least two two markings.
Every P1 has at least two.
Those markings comes from the intersection with other couple.
So if you have two divisors, you
have a first of a marking, then the automorphism is trivial.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Okay. Okay, with some stability conditions, and then you define, you can have this global wage invariance. And the structures of relative global Wheaton theory, here, before we talk about the structures, like we want to ask, why do we study relative global Wheaton theory? What's the reason to study relative global Wheaton theory? There are a lot of reasons. I mean, it's related to a lot of things that we wanted to study. Like, if we study relative global Wheaton theory, then the next thing, we can try to study relative mirror symmetry, mirror symmetry for pairs. And its relative global Wheaton invariance are related to absolute global Wheaton invariance and by degeneration. And so there is a relation in mirror symmetry. When you have some kind of degenerations, the mirrors, they are also related in, the mirrors will also be related in some way. And you can also generalize this to log global Wheaton invariance, which means when you have normal closing divisors, it's also related to some tautological class on MGM bar or on the moduli space of stable maps. It's related to double ramification cycles. These double ramification cycles, they can be defined using relative global Wheaton invariance. And it's also related to Hurwitz numbers. If you have relative global Wheaton invariance of P1 relative to zero infinity, and relative invariance can be, for some kind of relative invariance, it can be seen as like counting disk. In some sense, they can be seen as counting disk. Like if you have only one marking, then it's sort of like counting disk in the complement of the divisor. I mean, one marking means you touch the divisor at one point. If we remove these points, in some sense, it's a counting disk. It's not always true, but yeah. And since it's related to counting disk, it can be used like in SYZ mirror symmetry or closed Siebel program. And there are more, reasons why you can study relative global Wheaton theory, but I am running out of space here. So if I say enough, I think. I think I convince you that that's important thing to study. Now how do we study this, right? So relative global Wheaton invariance, they define about like 2 decades ago, the first paper here by Li Rong was on archive in 1998, so 20 years ago. And but there are a lot of properties that had been missing for relative global Wheaton theory. So this is a project that we started since last year to understand this structure properties of relative global Wheaton theory. And My approach is that we can start in an orbifold, but we can put an orbifold structure on the divisor, and we can translate the tangency conditions to some orbifold conditions, and then prove some relation between relative Kolmogorov invariance and that kind of orbifold Kolmogorov invariance. And so orbifold Kolmogorov theory is an absolute theory, an absolute Kolmogorov theory. So there are a lot of properties that has already known. So if we have such good relation between relative and orbifold invariance, then we can use the structures from orbifold theory to get the structures for relative theory. So that's the basic idea of the approach. I will say more about that. But the point is, relative theory, you think about it as a limit of orbifold theory.
I don't, like, what is this limit in? It's the limit is like if I could be completely misunderstanding. If you're saying this in a way, but imagine an orbifold which is sort of stacky only along D, mm-hmm. is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're somehow, is like the limit is the stackiness goes up?
I talk about this. Yeah. How I talk about how they are actually related.
Okay.
It's like what you say. Like the orbifold that I talk about is called Rudstack. So you have a stabilizer of mu r along d, and as r goes to infinity, like r gets big, and that be related to relative Kolmogorov theory. So how do I translate it to how do I translate this relative condition into orbifold condition? So we consider a moduli space which denoted by this. Now we have m plus m morphisms. The first m morphisms will be orbifold morphisms instead of relative morphisms, and the last m morphisms are still just ordinary morphisms. For this orbifold morphisms, now we have invariation maps, right? We have invariation maps from this moduli space to for orbifold theory, it's a little bit different. It's not mapped in a target, it's mapped in an inertial stack of the orbifold, which in general may be complicated. But in this case, our target is, so the image of this invariation map is just this one copy of x and r minus one copy of d. And this r minus one copy of d are called twisted zeros, and they are labeled by fractional numbers, 1 over r, 2 over r, to r minus 1 over r. And these fractional numbers are called the ages of the twisted zeros. Now, the way to translate it to translate the relative condition to orbifold condition is this. Since we have this inertial stack, which means we have two types of evaluation map. Again, if we have an orbifold marking, it's going to map to D. If we just have an ordinary marking or interior marking, then the image is X. And so for this orbifold markings, we get to choose which component of the twisted zeros we can map to. So that's we map to the component with h ki over r. Ki was our counter order in relative theory. So that's how you translate it to the orbifold setting. And So I'll have the modulized space. Again, we can use, we can consider these cohomology classes and pull back these cohomology classes. And then we can also have a number, which is an orbifold Gromov-Eaton invariant. And so the point here is that we have almost the same data. So this, we can use the same insertions. We have two kind of invariants, and they are defined using the same data. There's only one difference is that you have this orbifold theory, you have this R, positive integer R. So the orbifold invariance may be depending on R, but other than that, they define using the same data. So you have two things they define by the same data, and then the question you can ask is if they are related, if they are actually related. So for orbifold Gromov-Eaton theory, there's also a virtual dimension constraint. There's a difference in here because, like, so let's see how this works. So you have this minus sum of edges, and the edges are like in our previous set is sum of ki or r, which is this and cancel with this fractional number here. So you get an integer, which is the virtual dimension. If we don't have this, like if it's, so all these numbers are integers except for this one and this one. So they are equal, and then you get an integer. Otherwise, if it's not integer, then the dimension, I don't know what's like the meaning of a fractional dimension. I mean, the dimension has to be integer. And they don't have to be equal. Like they just need to have the same fractional part, then you get an integer for the virtual dimension, which means like the point here is you will have some orbifold invariants whose orbifold data is not exactly translated from relative data. So you have some extra orbifold Gromov-Eaton invariants, they are not defined like using this relative data. So there's some extra things that that becomes important later. But right now, the question is like, what's the relation between these two type of invariants, right? They define by the same data. If we actually talk about the relation, there are some facts, right? By Kadman, this modulized space of orbifold stable maps, it gives an alternative compactification of the modulized space of relative maps. And I mean, for different R, you have different kind of different compactification, but it provides an alternative compactification for the space of relative maps, which means if two invariants both counting something, they actually count something, they should be the same. So they are also determined by the same thing, like relative Gromov-Eaton theory is determined by absolute Gromov-Eaton theory of X, and absolute Gromov-Eaton theory of D, and the restriction map of the cohomology. And now the same thing, it also determines the orbifold Gromov-Eaton theory. So they determine by the same thing. Also, I don't know what's a good reason for giving this, but if you look at the anti-canonical class, get this negative kx minus d plus d or r, and when r gets to infinity, you get to negative kx minus d, which is kind of like the pair xd. So the point for this is just to say that they should be related when r gets to like large, gets to infinity. And so the in general zero is exactly true, like, so they are exactly the same as when r gets sufficiently large. And in particular, it means that all before invariance is supposed to depend on r, but when r gets large, it becomes independent of r, it gets stabilized, and relative invariance, you can think about them as limit of all before invariance. That's what it means, that relative theory can be considered as a limit of all before theory. There are some, so since r are large, which means these ages are small, and there are some orbifold invariants, they can be defined also, they can be defined using like large ages or like middle ages. There are some, there are large part of orbifold group of region theory that is not included in this equality. And yeah, so that's general zero. Now, we can talk about a higher genus case. The question is, if that's true in higher genus, unfortunately, it's not true in higher genus. There is a counterexample given by Malik that says that if we consider this example, x equals an elliptic curve called P1, and d equals d0, and d infinity, you have two divisors along 0 and infinity over P1, and there are some invariants, they computed that they are different in genus 1. So, which means the same thing doesn't work for higher genus. Yeah, it was kind of like the end of the story, but it's also the beginning of a story. Like you can ask some questions, which is here. You can ask like all these questions. Like the first question, of course, is what's the relation in higher genus, right? And they are not equal, but it doesn't mean they are not related. And the second question is, there are some extra orbifold invariants. Will they be related to relative invariants when they get stabilized when r gets large? And this, you can also ask if there's a mirror symmetry statement for the pairs. And there are more questions you can ask. But right now, let's talk about these questions. And we do have answers for these questions. I will go through this, begin with the first question. Now, what's the relation in higher genus? Right? So genus zero, they are equal. It's a counterexample in higher genus. Now, so the question is like, if you look at these two numbers, just look at numbers, zero, so r zero is the root we take in the first divisor, r infinity is the root that we take in the second divisor, is r zero plus r infinity. Now, can you see the relation between these two numbers? Like, they are not equal, of course, but what's the relation? I don't know if anyone has a conjecture relation for these two numbers. That's certainly a lot of possibilities. Like, you can come up with a lot of relations between these two numbers, but it's a really simple relation between these two numbers. And you see, anyone else? I think about this as a function in R0, R infinity. And should I just proceed to the next slide? Yeah, then there was someone that just saw this in a few seconds somehow. It took me 4 years to see the relation. And then I realized that's really simple relation. I should have seen that a long time ago. So there's a hint here. So this is the orbital invariant is a function R, right? In general zero, it becomes a constant function. Now in higher generals, it's not a constant function. Now, what is the function? It's simplest function I can think of, which is not constant.
Or?
So if you look at this, this is a linear function, right? In general, linear function is too good, right? And the next thing, like when you have linear function, then think about polynomials, right? And that is a polynomial. And it turns out it is a polynomial. And in R, when R gets large, and you think that what's the relation with relative invariance, right? And you have different coefficients there for the polynomials, and the coefficient that's related to the relative invariance is exactly in the constant part. It's the constant term, which is independent of R, right? Because relative invariance does not depend on R. The tangent part is independent of R, which is in the polynomial, which is the constant term. The constant term is exactly the relative Gromov-Witten invariant that you wanted. If you look at this, the constant term, if you look at this example, the constant term is zero. It should be true for all R. I mean, here in the contact order is just zero. For that example, there's no relative condition entry.
Can you tell us about like things like the degree of this polynomial?
That's a really good question. I got this question all the time, and in this paper, we didn't prove the degree of the polynomial, but recently, I think we know what's the degree. We are working on this. The degree should be bounded by 2g. So in g equals 0, then it's constant, right? So between 0 invariance will be constant. There is a bound for the degree of the polynomial.
So then the long example, like it was linear, but you're saying that a priori would have been quadratic.
So I don't know how, like maybe it's possible there is a better bound, but I don't know. Yeah. Like maybe for some certain special kind of Gromov-Witten theory, it's a better bound. So that's the hydrogens. I already said about this. So, which means this means that relative invariance they are determined by orbital invariance. Just taking a large R and then taking a constant term, you get again a relative invariance. I have a remark, say something about the proof. So in the original paper of Abramovich, Kadman, and Weiss, when they proved the general zero case, they have a different approach. We have a different approach. We have a different approach for this. In our result here, we didn't know the degree bound. This theorem, it does not imply an equality in general zero, but we can use the same proof, same approach that we have for higher genus and restricted to the general zero case, then we can prove, we can give a new proof for the equality in general zero case. And you can actually see the difference between general zero and higher genus, right? When you use our approach. And I'm not going to actually talk about the proof, but the proof use degenerations, virtual localizations, and also an important point is polynomiality of certain class, which is proved by Yanda, Penhari-Panda, Pixton, Drunken, when they computed double ramification cycles. So as I say, it's relative Gromov-Witten theory is related to double ramification cycles. So there's certain polynomiality that proved in their paper, and it turned out to be exactly what we want in here. So these papers are in 2017 and 18. And so we were trying to do this problem like earlier than that, so we didn't succeed. But yeah, so later we realized that's exactly what we want. Okay. And the second question is, you have some extra orbital Gromov-Witten invariance, and when it be related to relative invariance, and in we first talk about the general zero case. In general zero, answer is no, but it's actually, the answer is actually yes. Depends on how you see this. If you just look at the invariance depending on R, and it goes to zero as R goes to infinity, but this is not exactly what we want. I mean, if you just get zero, then there's not so much things you can say about it, right? And the real thing, the correct thing to look at is this invariant multiplied by R to certain power. So this M minus is the number of large edges. So previously we talked about all these small edges. Now if you have some large edges, the correct thing to look at is this thing. It gets stabilized, it's not zero. And now what's the meaning of this? It gets stabilized, and it's, the question to ask is stabilized to what? Right? If it's related to relative Gromov-Witten invariance. But all the relative Gromov-Witten invariance, they already correspond to these small edges. I get these extra things, which means you need to, that's my question, right? So all the relative invariance are already in the previous results. Now, that means you have some extra orbital invariance, and you need to extend the definition for relative Gromov-Witten invariance. You need to introduce some extra invariance on the relative side, which is called negative counter orders. In general zero, they are equal. And so there's a there's a picture I can draw. So, okay, drawing here. So if you have a variety with a divisor and you're counting curves with some tangency conditions, these are positive counting orders. So for the moduli space to be compact, you have some, like, it's possible to have some components that map into the divisor, and this will not make sense in here. Then in that case, you have to do degeneration to the normal cone to get something called rubber. Rubber target. So you change the target, you get curves like this. So right now we still have all the positive counting orders. Now for the negative counting order to appear, you need to allow some kind of curves like this. So this will be negative. And now you may think about this, like, so in the original definition, you have this so-called kissing conditions in the middle. They have to match. And so here you can think about this as positive, this as negative, and there's a negative counted order coming up in this way. And then that's a geometric definition. And for this kind of relative chromophobic invariance, and of course you can also define it just as a limit of orbifold theory, but you want to have a theory that for relative chromophobic invariance that does not depend on the language of orbifold chromophobic theory, right? So that's the picture that you can have in a relative theory. They are equal. And now, so that's the correspondence. Previously, we have this ki, it corresponds to small h's when ki is positive. We have this h, ki, or r. Now, if we have negative ki, then we have this large h's r plus ki or r. And that's the correspondence. Yeah, now the question, now we have this extra invariance. Like, you want to ask, why do we care about this extra invariance? Why do we need to include this invariance? The reason is that we need this invariance to have all the structure properties, all the nice structure properties for relative chromophobic theory. We have quantum cohomology, then we can have relative quantum cohomology. We have topological recursion relation, WDVV equation, given task formal reason, with the solar constraints. But if we do not include this extra invariance, then you will not have these properties. That's why these invariants are important. So that is my title, Structures of Relative Chromophobic Theory. Because I still have time, so I have more things to say. So this is related to the puncture chromophobic invariance that defined in Gross-Seibel program. So Gross-Seibel program is the algebraic version of SYZ conjecture. They have this definition for puncture invariance for normal crossing divisors. Our definition should be related to theirs. So since we still have time, let's look at some other questions. Like, we talk about small ages and large ages, and what's in the middle? And there's still a lot of invariants, orbifold invariants in the middle. And do we know what's the meaning for this extra orbital invariance. And we already have nice properties for relative theory by including large energies. But do we have something to say about these things in the middle? Unfortunately, we do not have a good answer for that. I mean, this mid-ages, right? Like, this mid-ages is difficult, right? Everyone knows that. And it's difficult. So we didn't know what's the answer for mid-age. And And I mean, you have positive Cantor order and negative Cantor order already. I don't know what can you say, like, what's in the middle. So, but it might be important for some other things. But right now we do not have an answer, like, for what do we do with these things in the middle. Hi, Genus. So previously I just talked about Genus zero, but now what's higher Genus? Right? In higher Genus, we have this extra orbital invariance with large edges. And what's the relation between this and the relative invariance? So I think you can guess what's the relation, which is by combining the previous two results together, which means for all before invariance multiplied by this r to the m minus 1 power, it's a polynomial, and the constant term is the higher genus relative Gromovitch invariant. And of course, that requires some extra proof. And when you have this, you can have a partial cohomological field theory for relative Gromov-Witten theory. And so that's one of the reasons to consider the higher genus case in here. And the third question is that if there's a mismatch statement for pairs, so don't know how much I want to explain here. So at the beginning, I talked about this mirror symmetry statement of J function equals I function, and J function is a generating function of Gromov-Witten invariant, and the I function is some hypergeometric series or hypergeometric modification in here, and it's a hypergeometric modification of the J function. But the point here is just that is an I function. You can construct it for root stack. This theorem can be proved by using orbifold quantum left sheets, which proved by Zen in his thesis, in his dissertation. Also using the mirror theorem for Torrey step bundles, which is actually my dissertation. And combine them together, you'll get this result. Which means there's a mirror symmetry statement for root stack. And then you take the limit, you'll get the I function for pairs.
Do you understand what the mirror is here?
I don't know. So you mean what's the mirror for the pair?
Yeah.
So the mirror, so in general, I don't know, but like if you have an anti-canonical divisor, the mirror is going to be a Landau-Ginzburg model, right? It's going to be a fiber-wise compactification of this. So the fiber, a generic fiber will be mirrored to the divisor. So if this is anti-canonical, smooth anti-canonical divisor, and that's going to be in the mirror of that. But in general, I don't know if there's any like good theory about that.
If I have the root stack, what does the fiber become?
Root stack, I don't know. Like maybe some kind of orbifold here, and then the limit is D check.
Is it what?
Yeah, but that's this has already appeared in lots of literatures. Like you have anti-smooth anti-canonical divisor and the mirror is this. And I don't know if you can have root stack and consider the mirror and then take a limit to get this. I don't know if that's possible. Like we kind of talk about this, but yeah. I don't have a good way to take a limit to this mirror object. So. Yeah, but it's an interesting question, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, which means like that's going to be related to the mirror of the complement, right? So, if it's possible that there's a way like you consider the mirror of the root stack and then take some kind of limit, you get a mirror of the complement and may give you another construction. Yeah, I don't have answer for that right now. Yeah, so in here we just talk about the enumerative result. You have the I function, and well, there are some applications. I think I should have time to talk about this. And there's an application like for SYZ mirror symmetry, and like. The intuition is if you have a pair, you have one relative marking, you kind of think about it as a counting, so it's counting curves in X meeting D at one point. You can kind of think of it as counting disk in the complement, and you can think about this as an algebraic version of counting disk. Although there's no Lagrangian here in general, but it's heuristic. In some case, you can do that, like you can actually prove the relation between some relative invariance and orbifold invariance. Like if you have a totally club ER and some relative invariance of the totally compactification of X, that would be the same as some kind of open Kolmogorov invariance, which this open invariance they are used in SYZ construction. So you can also use relative invariance in this setting because they're just the same as open invariance. And another thing I also kind of mentioned about that at the beginning is if you have a degeneration is of a club ER variety, and there's a way to relate the mirrors of the mirrors of X and the mirror of X1D and X2D. Right? So, for example, consider the degeneration of quintic, you can degenerate into P1 and Q4, quarter threefold, but you need to blow up something in P1 or P3. And so you have mirrors for these pairs. And this D is K3 surface. As I say in there, the mirrors for these pairs will be Landau-Ginzburg models. And the fiberized compactification of this. The generic fiber will be mirrored to D. Now there's a conjecture that says that you can glue these Landau-Ginzburg models together, you can get fibration over P1, and this X check should be in the mirror of X. And like you have degeneration on one side, you go to the mirror side, you can glue them together, get the mirror of the original club Yaw. In terms of periods, like on the mirror side, On the Landau-Ginzburg model, you have this family of club ERs. You consider an appearance for these Landau-Ginzburg models. You can also glue them together to get the glue in some sense. Together, that becomes the appearance of the original club ER with correlated by some the periods of the intersection. So you can prove this conjecture on the level of these periods. That's our recent result. So as a summary, this relative invariance limit of orbifold invariance. And relative invariance with negative Condé orders are inevitable. And if you want to have a good theory, a good structures of relative theory, there's a relative mismatch and there's some applications. So since we just built these structures, so it's there are a lot of things that can be done. I still have a lot of things that didn't list in here, but it's a new direction and there are a lot of things that can be done. That's the point. And that's our reference here. I think you can stop.
Questions. Did you know anything about control for invariance of P1 or controlled by a certain integral hierarchy?
Yeah,
is there
I know.
Case?
That's one of the things. Did I list in here? Maybe I didn't list in here. But that's one of the things that we wanted to know, like P1 relative to 2 points. There's an integral hierarchy. Yeah. That should be related. Then there are some results for like weighted projective lines. Like it has integrable hierarchies, and that may be related to this relative theory. But that's one of the things that we want to do. Yeah. Mm.
Could you make some comments on causal theory? So what do we have to look for?
So we have partial cohomological field theory right now, but there's one assumption that's missing. It's called a loop assumption. So if you have inheritance, if you have a loop, then you break the loop, you write the invariance as like sum of lower genus invariance, but that. We don't have that assumes in relative theory. Like it's like you have if you break it, then you may have positive, and so you get two markings. That may like positive and negative Condé orders, but it's like you can get to infinity, right? You can have Condé order 1, 2, and then goes to infinity, you may have infinite sum. Like that, so it doesn't make sense in this case, but we have partial cohomological field theory, and also go back to Karen's question is that there are some papers says that if you have a partial cohomological field theory, then there will be an integrable system that's related to this theory. Yeah. So, yeah.
Given all story, there's all these nice results about changes of polarization corresponding to, K theory versus cohomology. This the top codes thesis.
Okay.
Or like descendant for invariants versus other ancestors.
Okay.
Given all group acting
asymmetries,
does all this happen here?
I have not done that yet, so I don't know. I mean, hydrogen like gets more complicated. Now, we don't have Venusaur constraint in hydrogenlessness. We have gender zero. We can write down these Venusaur operators, but like these quantizations, we don't, you know, it doesn't make sense somehow. Yeah.
Other questions?
Thank you.